South. Sitting in the boat with an Eskimo hunter high on the Arctic Sea, and suddenly feel myself the sheer top of the world. Continents reeling away far beneath me. Old Europe, older Asia, young America, timeless Africa, newborn Australia, etc. For the world is etc. in relation to the Arctic, with tidal coastlines gathered together down there from my illusion of upness, which has no east or west or anything to do with roads, lakes, oceans, deserts, etc. The world is simply south. The world shrinks away from me, gathers itself as a ghostly premise in my own head. Tragedy, comedy, boredom, love, impersonal abstractions here, objectively mixed together without correlatives. But the match I strike and flick at the water conceivably could circle the hemispheres. The shout I shout could travel through mountains, tremble down moving glaciers, there finding still hissing skeletons of ancient reptiles, frozen mammoths under the mile-deep ice cap, half a step short of where they were going, and scribble a singing decibel on eternity, searching out an ultimate listener, the Seal King, lording it over the pack ice. Myself, elated by the grandiose, standing up in the boat, reciting a poem to Jonasy, the Eskimo hunter, though he doesn't understand it, waving my arms and declaiming, intonations, nuances, and everything, ad lib a line when I stumble, recover magnificently. Laurence Olivier feeling his oatmeal, Alec Guinness unsober at Stratford, Henry Irving rambunctious on Broadway, and ad nauseam. I don't know how my Eskimo hunter feels, whether he's embarrassed a little, or simply wants to applaud a fine performance, but the icebergs drift away south to find an interesting coffee house, and Jonasy giggles. Reaction sets in, and brooding by the gunwales, I think of Schopenhauer's The World as Will and Idea, and whatever the hell the rest of it is. Take no account of time and external events until Jonasy's sudden gun goes boom, boom, and alakazam, a seal. The small, whiskered, comic, dead face. The Eskimo hunter and his weapons, and a middle-aged white man in an open boat together, and seal blood drifting down the ocean currents to touch shores of continents, an idea for animals. The seal, being not quite dead, is properly whacked with a paddle, and the whiskered, innocent, surprised face supplies a choice of morals. A choice of morals. Hey, Jonasy, reach over the package of whale sandwiches, pass me the sack butt of fermented blubber juice, and drink a toast to the world. Drink to all our illusions, the power of necessity and the competitive idea that made you a great hunter in the era of welfare checks and family allowance. A toast to the pessimists, like Haussmann and Schopenhauer, and the optimists, such as Leibniz and Robert Browning. Drink to the 20 names for snow, and the million names of God, Baalbek, Enlil, Bel Marduk, Vishnu, Shiva. Drink to Ishtar, Osiris, Horus, Quetzalcoatl, and Lyndon B. Johnson. To Sedna the One-Eyed, combing her long hair on the sea bottom, under the icebergs. Drink to them, and to Jonasy, the archetypal hunter. Hey, Jonasy, are you listening? Somewhat later, stand up in the boat, observing the practical necessity of water, finding its own level, easing the left kidney, especially. Reverse blessing on the world. From a sacrilegious well-wisher, impure joy and powerful impulse, love and hate together, a libation from the Arctic, blood of a most experienced lambkin, stand up in the boat, rocking gently in all directions south, and say, look out down there, Kyrgyzstan Islands. Where will I find the damn thing? Ah, I am. Alec Guinness, unsober at Stratford. Henry Irving, rambunctious on Broadway. Ouch. Alec Guinness, unsober at Stratford. Henry Irving, rambunctious on Broadway. Ad nauseam. I don't know how my Eskimo hunter feels, whether he's embarrassed a little, or simply wants to applaud a fine performance. tent rings. Tent rings. Stones in a circle on an island in the Kikistan group, placed there long ago to hold down the skirts of caribou skin tents. All over the Arctic, these tent rings, going back thousands of years in the land where nothing changes. The Dorset people of Baffin, nomads down the centuries in hustling sea wind, left them and journeyed on. Thule people of Greenland, the wild skraelings of Norse legend, wanderers among the islands in the Beaufort Sea, left such rings of stone. The radioactive detective, Carbon 14, provides no calendar, though it dates horn scrapers, ivory spearheads, and bones of men. Here's another one, weathered granite boulders from the Precambrian, before there was life at all, arranged here 50 years ago, or several thousand. In some sense, I think of them as still here in the circle. The small brown men, they live so strongly, with such a gift of laughter. The morning sun touches and glances off their sparkling ghosts. To enter these tent rings is mingling with the past, being in two places, having visions, hearing voices sounding in your head, almost like madness, summoned by wizard Angakoks, a thousand-year-old spell, relayed and handed down, a legacy from dead to the living. Turning away from here, now in the future, I suppose, the stones will be rectangular, even octagonal maybe, having the shape of canvas tents that came from white traders. And some visitor in the far future, probably non-human, will notice them and not know whether they belong to the Inuit, the men preeminently, or white men, who were also visitors and thought to be human. Kikistan Islands. Track meet at Bangnirtung. The young Eskimo mothers line up for a foot race, leaving babies with the old women. When the Anglican minister says, go, they gallop like rainbows, a dozen of them, in white parkas with red and blue trim, laughing and panting to the finish line to reclaim their babies. A white construction worker gives one old woman a package of cigarettes as payment for taking her picture. So she smiles. A smile from her ancient youth he takes away with him into the leapfrog future. The different age groups of children line up for sack races and piggyback races, boy and girl races. And the husbands lounge off to one side, trying to act as if they don't enjoy it. All of them, sea hunters from the Hungry Islands, now weaponless. No one seems to mind losing here, for losing is a kind of pleasure when a wounded seal doesn't swim away under the ice. And laughter is a red filling between the hours. Laughter is ignorant wisdom of the young, as the old men and their bones know, having laughed many times, with serious faces still in the running. Bangnirtung. What do the birds think? Are the exiles here from the rest of the world? Deja vu past egg and atom from the yellow Sahara Ocean? Or farmlands in Ontario, a witness hanging daubed in the rural blue, while a plowman half a mile down in a dark field with a snoring tractor moves in circular sleep? Are exiles from the apple country, where macks and spies plop soft on wet ground in slow autumn days, with the rotten, tangy odor of cider rising on moon-wept nights? Have they lists and a summary of things elsewhere, and remember the crimson racket encountering tropic strangers, or nests of an old absence, lined with a downy part of themselves, far south? And being south, do they think sometimes of the rain and mists of Baffin, and long migrations wingtip to wingtip a mile high, and mate to mate in the lift and tremble of windy muscles, pushing them where? And do they ever, an arrow leader pointing the way, touch wearily down on ships passing, rest here a while and go on? Forgotten in the hurry of their streaming generations, another captain called Noah, Vajarni Herjolfsson, in horned helmet, and the sweep silver lifting to alluring Hyperborean ocean. Her whaling ships myopic stumbling from dull wave to dull wave, and the paint of the bright over the horizon gazing woman flaked with salt. How are we kept here? By what bonds are we always exiles? The chirping roar in the silence of foxes and watery romp of walrus in the long sea lands, or perched on rubbery muskeg like blue teacups or lost brown mittens. By what agency of restlessness in the driftwood heart? Until on a day the eggs hatch and the young are trained to endurance, ice rattles the shroud of summer, the flight plans sent, the logbook sand is scribbled on, goodbye, we are going, hurry, and mounting a shaft of sunlight or the mizzen mast of the sky, they climb and go. And that is the way it is, except perhaps I wonder, do they ever remember, down there in the Southland, Cumberland Sound, and the white places of Baffin, that I will remember soon. Bang your tongue. HBC Post. Here Eskimos come with sealskins, the bread and butter of the Arctic. A rare polar bear, some fox maybe. They bring in a bundle of furs and throw it on the floor. And look at the post manager. $7 is the price for a good ring seal. $14 for the glossy patterned harp seal. But many have bullet holes or other imperfections. The HBC man inspects the furs, decides on a fair price, and notes it down, hands the slip of paper with an offered amount to the hunter. Then a slight pause, as one optimistic estimate meets the concrete fact of the money they're worth. No bargaining at all. The manager talks to the hunter in his own language, explains the reasons behind his price, picks out a fault here and another there, and the transaction ends with acceptance. Another hunter is waiting. But in the Eskimo's mind I have seen clothes for the whole family, new rifles with telescopic sights, 100-pound sacks of flour and groceries, shining marine engines, clean white tents, stacked up dream high in his mind, come tumbling down. Bang your tongue. The sculptors. Going through cases and cases of Eskimo sculpture, returned from Frobisher, because they said it wasn't good enough for sale to Tiyeton Company Limited. Getting itchy Excelsior packing inside my shirt, and searching for one good carving, one piece that says, I am, to keep a southern promise. 1 6-inch walrus, tusk broken, cribbage board, ivory inlay gone, dog that has to be labeled dog, polar bear, badly crippled, but might be a seal, minus flipper. I'm getting tired of this, looking for something, not knowing what it is. But I guess they got tired too, looking for rabbit or bear, with blisters from carving tools, dime-sized and inflating into quarters on their fingers, waiting for a walrus or white whale under the ice floes to flop alive on their lap, with twitching animal faces, unready to taste the shoe blacking carvers use for stone polish. I'm a little ashamed of myself for being impatient with them. But there must be something, there must be something. One piece that glows. One slap-happy idiot seal, alien to the whole seal nation. One anthropomorphic walrus singing, Hallelujah, I'm a bum, in a whiskey baritone. But they're all flawed, broken, bent, misshapen. Failed animals, with vital parts missing. And I have a sudden vision of the carvers themselves in this broken sculpture, as if the time and the place and me had clicked into brief alignment, and a switch pulled, so that I can see and feel what it was like to be them, the TB outpatients, failed hunters who make a noise at the wrong time, or think of something else at the trigger moment, and shine their eyes into a continual tomorrow, the losers and failures who never do anything right, never will. The unlucky ones, always on the verge of a tremendous discovery, who finally fail to deceive even themselves as time begins to hover around them. The old, the old, the old, who carve in their own image the maimed animals. I'd like to buy every damn case. Bang your tongue. at the movies. The setting is really unreal. About 150 Eskimos and whites jammed into a Nissen hut to watch Gary Cooper and Burt Lancaster in a Technicolor Western shoot 'em up. Eskimos don't understand the dialogue at all, but they like the action. When noble Gary is in danger, or sinister Lancaster acts menacing, tide of emotion sweeps the hot little hut, and kids crawling on the floor are quiet, sensing what their parents feel, that something tremendously important is happening. When the Anglican minister changes reels, his blonde head glinting as he administers spiritual unction to his flock, cigarettes are lit, and everyone talks, and the kid crawls under my legs, grinning bashfully. Jim Killebuck says something I can't quite hear. A baby cries in the pouch on his mother's back. It's joggled gently. It's hot and stuffy as hell in the theater. Doors have to be opened. The odor of white and Eskimo making a point for air conditioning. Lights go out and Gary Cooper rides again. The forces of evil are finally defeated. Only the virtuous bullet kills. Violence neutralizes violence, like a mustard plaster, though I kind of like the bad guy, the way it always does in American movies, with an obvious moral, a clear-cut denouement. Outside, the fjord looks like poured blue milk, mountains like bookmarks under a cold sky. Islands are moonscapes where this story happens. It's 11 p.m. Some of the hunters visit their boats, where dead caribou drain into bilge water. The rest of the moviegoers go home to tents on the beach or prefab houses, and dogs howl to make everything regional. But the point I'd hoped to separate from all these factual things stubbornly resists me. I walk home slowly, feeling stupid, rejecting the obvious, threading my way between stones and the mud with the beginnings of a headache. Bang your tongue. One of the things about that particular poem was, all the Eskimos are going to the movies to watch Gary Cooper and Burt Lancaster, whatever Western it was, and they found it highly exciting after just having come a good many miles to shoot caribou, which strikes me as far more exciting. The country of the young. A.Y. Jackson, for instance, 83 years old, halfway up a mountain, standing in a patch of snow to paint a picture that says, "Look here, you've never seen this country. It's not the way you thought it was. Look again." And boozy traders, lost in a dream of money, crews of homesick seamen, moored to a China vision, hunting the Northwest Passage. They didn't see it either. The colors, I mean. For they're not bright Gauguin or blazing Vincent. Not even Bruegel's Hunters in the Snow. You can get lost and found in 5 minutes. But the original color matrix that after a giant's heartbeat lighted the maple forests in the country's south. You have to stoop a little, bend over, and then look up. Dull orange on a cliff face that says iron deposits. Olive leaves at the ground willow with gray silver catkins. Minute wildflower beacons. Sea blue as the world's eye. And you can't be looking for something else. Money, or a night's lodging on earth, a stepping stone to death, maybe, or you'll never find the place, hear an old man's voice in the country of the young that says, "Look here." Pang your tongue. That was the last poem in the book. There are a few notes on unfamiliar terms and references. The Northwest Passage, page 20. Skraelings were the natives encountered by Thorfinn Karlsefni on the east coast of North America, as described in the Icelandic sagas. Probably they were Dorset Eskimos. Arctic River, page 22. The quotation at the beginning of the poem is from C.F. Hall's book, Life with the Eskimo, 1865. Hall was an American explorer, discoverer of the Sylvia Grinnell River, which he named after the daughter of his financial sponsor. The Eskimo Thule culture succeeded the Dorsets, beginning about 900 A.D., to 1750. Thule people were whale hunters, using the bones for house rafters. They too disappeared, replaced by the modern Eskimo. Both Dorset and Thule people and their ancestors figure in Eskimo legends as Tunits or Tunjiks, shadowy giants of prehistory. Some 5,000 years ago, ancestors of the modern Eskimo are thought by archaeologists to have crossed eastward over the Bering Sea on a land or ice bridge, which of course no longer exists. Canso, page 34. The myth of Sedna, and so alternatively Nuliuk and Taliuk, still lives among the Eskimos today, despite the advent of Christianity. In the version I know, Sedna was a beautiful Eskimo girl who lived with her father beside the sea. She enraged him by rejecting all her many suitors. One day when father and daughter were out at sea in their skin boat, a storm came up suddenly. The old hunter thought his daughter was responsible for the storm and threw her overboard, poking out one of her eyes with a paddle, cutting off her fingers when she tried to climb back into the boat. Sedna's severed fingers miraculously came to life in the water and turned into ocean mammals. She herself sank to the sea bottom, where she kept many of the animals captive. Sedna lives there still, on the bottom of the sea, combing her long hair like a princess in a fairy tale, waiting for some previously luckless Eskimo hunter to flatter her into releasing seal and walrus as food for his hungry family. Over the centuries, she has somehow managed to acquire a human husband, a soft-hearted, henpecked man who is continually trying to release the captive animals. Still Life in a Tent, page 47. The passage, "Pounding motherless bergs to death on rocks, stranding the big calves," stems from the fact that glaciers are said to calve when icebergs break off from their sea edges. Eskimo Hunter, page 57. I'm told that Jonasi, the Eskimo referred to here, was a remarkably efficient hunter, else he would not have possessed all that equipment. Tent Rings, page 69. The term Angakok is the Eskimo equivalent of shaman or witch doctor. There are said to be still a few of them in the Arctic, in spite of missionaries. What do the birds think? Page 73. The phrase, "bright over the horizon gazing woman," refers to figureheads on old sailing ships of the last century. And that is the end of North of Summer.